Hey, hey, influencer, welcome back to part two of our interview with Ian Greenlee. And in case if you missed part one yesterday, you'll definitely want to go back and download that one as well, because he just shared so much good information about all things social media. And today, in part two, you'll get to hear from Ian how to evaluate someone's influence on social media beyond their clout score, and also what a clout score really even means. He also told the story of how he busted someone with over 100,000 Twitter followers, where, let's just say, not all of those accounts were real. And he talked about how to get guest blogging opportunities on blogs where you don't have a relationship with the site's owner yet. We also talked about how to grow your Twitter following really fast, and how to use criticism in a respectful way on Twitter to build connections. We even talked about how to use social media to warm up cold leads and what to include in your content marketing strategy to grow your influence. So, without any further ado, here's Ian Greenlee. This is Esther Kish.
And this is Meta Muller.
And you just caught the latest episode of Born to Influence, the marketing show.
What is the big deal with clout score, and what is the importance of it, and how do you weigh it in versus some of the other factors when you're considering working with someone that needs to be in an influential position, whether for a job that they are looking to, you know, to be hired for, or if it's a marketing consultant or somebody is an outsourced company? How much of an actual metric can we get from clout scores?
Well, I don't advocate using any single metric to make decisions with. I don't care what it is. But I will say that I know the guys at Clout, and I was very skeptical of what they were doing. But when they kind of showed me, you know, it's not really a single metric in the sense that it's going out there and it's looking at all these different factors that together indicate influence. That's a whole lot more reliable than just one factor like number of Twitter followers.
Mm-hmm.
So just looking at it through that lens, it's already miles ahead. People like to point to these anomalies, right, of Justin Bieber had a higher clout score than President Obama or something like that. I don't remember if that was the one, but there are a few like that. And that's true. But an algorithm is not going to be right all the time. And when you can find a whole, like a high-profile example of where it's wrong, that's what the media gravitates to. And so I think that is a challenge for clout, is that when it's not right, it's really not right. But again, taken with anecdotal evidence, like have they been, if you're looking to like find a blogger, for instance, to endorse your product or something, don't just look at the clout score, but maybe use it as a starting place. I think that can go wrong. One time I was at a party that was sponsored by a consumer electronics phone company, and they were just giving phones out to people with the highest clout score. And I think that is misguided, because it wasn't really looking at, like, do these people even blog about consumer electronics?
Mm-hmm.
But I know for a fact that clout wouldn't advocate doing things like that. They were just the data provider in this case. If you talk to them, they'd probably say, well, people are influential in different categories, and they've got data about those categories. So maybe if they had used clout a little more granularly and looked at, here are the people with high influence in this specific space, that would have been a lot more effective use of giving away free phones, which still, the practice of giving away free phones is kind of a dark art anyway. But but if you're going to do it, I guess, of course, make sure that this is obligatory that I have to say this, but make sure that the person discloses that they got a free phone, or else you're probably in violation of some FTC rules. But anyway, clout as a starting point, I think that's the best place for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember, you know what, but because I just don't understand you still so much and well enough, I think, with what's the deal with cloud, because I know I've been getting some magazine subscriptions and cosmetics and all kinds of perks, even though my cloud score, to me, is not particularly high. So I'm wondering how those companies are really using this data, but why?
But see, that's probably an indication that cloud score, the cloud score is not the best metric, but the other data that Clout has is accurate. I mean, do you like blog about cosmetics, or do you have any idea why they're targeting you?
No, that's the thing that I received anything from McDonald's to a magazine subscription to some product like cosmetic samples. It was like all kinds of different industries, and really what I talk about in social media is marketing.
Yeah, well. That's probably an example of where that targeting is misguided, but I know that they've got the data to do it right, and that's probably on the clients of Clout, not necessarily on Clout. I don't get paid by them or anything like that, but I do know them, so I guess I'm biased. I'm friends with some of them. But it is true that, like, that's not the best use of influencer discovery technology to give you McDonald's and cosmetics samples, but the data is there, and Clout could be the one to provide it, so that someone that actually blogs about cosmetics could be kind of very appropriately approached. They've got that data, and they've got a lot more of it than most companies in the same space, because they've been at it for so long, and they've got so many users.
Okay, so if cloud score is part of it, what are some of the other elements that we need to be looking at when we are really trying to determine if somebody is, in fact, influential in terms of social media?
Activity. Look at if they're generating evidence of people caring about what they're saying. I was on a panel once with someone who I had never heard of. We were there to talk to small businesses about using social media effectively. And I was like, this guy's from Austin. I've never heard of him, but he has 100,000 Twitter followers. There's something fishy about that, because I had met so many of the people in Austin in this space through networking events and through Twitter chats and things like that, that for this guy to kind of slip through the cracks and slip through the radar was fishy. And when I looked at his Twitter stream, he wasn't engaging with anybody. He was just kind of tweeting RSS feeds of his blog posts, which were not very good. And he wasn't getting any retweets or reactions. So it turns out, I'm relatively certain he was buying Twitter followers, because he was gaming social proof. At this point, this was probably back in 2010, people were looking at social media numbers, like followers, as the gospel. Like, that is the end-all, be-all. That's how we should judge people, at least influence-wise. And at that point, that was still wrong, but it was more forgivable because we didn't have great tools otherwise. So I have a feeling that's why he got on the panel. And he wasn't very good. You know, he wasn't a great panelist. But I think that, look at natural indicators of influence, and just like conversation around this person. Is he generating, he or she generating conversation? Are they getting likes and plus ones and things like that? Again, I mean, that can be game too, I guess, with bots and such, but you can never know for sure. Do they have comments on their blog? Or, I mean, some of it is non-social. Like, I don't get a lot of blog comments, but McGraw-Hill published my book. Like, maybe that's a good indicator that at least I know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Or maybe not. Maybe you don't consider that a good indicator. You got to decide for yourself. Like, what do you as an individual or business, what do you feel indicates that someone is influential in quote-unquote real life in the physical world, if social media didn't exist, and then try to find social media equivalents to those things. So, for instance, like if you were in academia before social media existed, you might look at the number of times this academic has been cited in journals, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the equivalent of that maybe is links to them, links to their blog from other blogs that you respect. Or you can kind of triangulate their Twitter followers and say, do people that I respect follow this person? I like that indicator a lot, because if I can see that bloggers that I really like and that I respect this person, that means something. Because mm-hmm. these people don't follow just any old person.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good way also to look at when you want to find someone new, that, okay, who can I talk to about this particular topic? You can just look at people who you respect. Who are they following, and find somebody that maybe you never heard about before as well.
Yes, and I like doing that. It goes back to finding people that surround people that you already know are influential, because those people are easier to access, and they'll probably give you the time of day and be more engaging with you. So mm-hmm. you'll develop social proof in that way. Like, the ultimate way to do this is to find, where do these people leave comments? Like, are they, like, they might have like a blog rule on their blog that says kind of, here are the blogs I read, but who knows when that was updated. Mm. But if you look for signs of activity, like where are they actually leaving comments and what blogs are they actually tweeting about, and then you develop a relationship with the people that maintain those blogs, whether it starts as just commenting, maybe you guest post there. That technique has led to a lot of success for me, because I couldn't have gone directly to the person at the center of this sphere of influence and said, hey, you don't know me, but can I run this guest post for you? They would have been like, yeah, I don't know you, and no. Mm-hmm. But if they had seen that I was blogging at all these blogs that they read, then I can just point to that. Hey, I know you're a reader of this. I see you comment there sometimes, or talk to this guy on Twitter or whatever. Well, I've been doing guest posts for them and it's gone really well. Would you consider looking at mine for your blog? Like, when once you get to that level and you can prove that people you care about, people that you find influential or you pay attention to, are paying attention to me, that's social proof. Then mm-hmm. you should pay attention to me too. And it works really well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that. Now, Ian, you've mentioned Twitter quite a number of times here. So if, you know, let's say that you were starting a completely new Twitter profile, you of course had tons of content behind you and so forth, but you were starting a completely new Twitter profile and you could only use three different tactics to grow that, to grow your following. What would those three tactics be in order to grow a following in the least amount of time?
Okay, all of these tactics are going to revolve around the core principle of providing value and being useful. Mm-hmm. The first one would be curation. By that I mean identifying the space that you want to be influential in and figuring out, how can I be useful by collecting and disseminating content that people in that space would find interesting. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, when I talk to them about starting off in social media, their first big concern is, I just don't have the time to create all this content. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're going to have to create some content, but it's a lot easier, and I think you reach kind of influence a lot faster if, alongside of the content you're creating and the voice that you're cultivating, you're also sharing the work of people whom you respect and in that space. So that's going to do two things. Not only are you providing value to your growing audience on Twitter because you're sharing with them interesting articles that they may have missed, but you're also providing value to the people who are creating that content. And one simple way to grow your network in those two ways at the same time is to make sure that the people whose content you're sharing know that you're sharing it by using their Twitter handle. Like, so-and-so blog post by this at this person. Mm-hmm. So they'll get pinged. They'll know this person's sharing. maybe a quarter of the time they'll follow you, and then you can develop a better relationship with that person. And if you think about creating a mix of content from people that are already really influential, well, then that's great, because you're building a circle of influence of influencers in that space. But also, don't exclusively do that. Look for opportunities to shed light on the work of people that are emerging. Because I think everyone likes to see like fresh ideas, new ideas. Yeah. And if you're talking about like these are influencers in this category, in this space, sometimes they all kind of blend together and sound the same, or they're talking about the same thing.
Mm.
And it's kind of part of the way that you can be useful is to bring new voices and to shed light on them. So that's curating. Another thing I do, and this is just general, is look for opportunities to help the people that you want to get in front of. If you've got a list of 100 people that influence you in a certain space, in the space that you're trying to be influential in, and you are looking at that list obsessively, you're going to find ways to help them get to where they want to be. And you never know. Like, I think people approach influence as there are these this ladder, and if you're on the bottom rung, the person on the top rung is not going to pay attention to you. And that's, maybe in some ways that's true, but if you give them a reason to, like, even people like, I don't know, David Pogue, 1.5 million followers, he's now at Yahoo, was at the Wall Street Journal. He was a journalist, and he needs sources for things. So maybe he's tweeting about, hey, I need someone that has experience with this company, you know, email me. Or, like, you can introduce people to people that you think they would find interesting. When I was in London, I was there for business, and I was shooting these videos. And one of the videos was with this artist. She was incredibly active in this open data movement. And I knew a journalist that was happened to be visiting London at the same time that really cares and writes about open data. So I connected those two people, and they got drinks. And I feel like now I've got a better relationship with both those two people. And they'll remember me as the person that connected them to someone they found interesting. And I did that exclusively over Twitter. I happened to be in London, but it didn't work out. I couldn't actually meet up with them. So I could have been anywhere in the world. So that things like that, it's like even if someone's way more influential than you and well-known, you can find opportunities to help them in small ways, track down some information that they're trying to find. Or, you know, I think that criticism is helpful, respectful criticism of their work. Like, hey, I disagree, and here's why. Start that conversation on Twitter. You know, follow it up with a blog comment, or maybe write a blog post that is kind of breaking down why you feel that they're a little bit off. And respectfully doing so, everyone will pay attention to someone that disagrees with them. They've got enough people being yes men around them and saying, oh, yes, sir, you know, this is great stuff. You're the best.
Yeah.
Look at Chris Brogan's Twitter feed for evidence of that. Everyone's sucking up to him all the time. I doubt he really pays attention to that because he's so used to it. But imagine if someone disagrees with him. I really didn't find your blog post to be that accurate for these reasons or something like that. You know, he'll probably pay attention to those people. And if you're doing that in a respectful way, constructive criticism, I think normal people find that interesting. They want to know kind of what your story is.
And do you
especially
think,
if they're so used to effort.
Is it possible to share constructive criticism in, what is it, 140 characters? Because I'm already sitting here thinking, oh, how would you do that in one tweet?
Well, it doesn't have to be in one tweet.
Yeah.
Just keep, you know, break. You should still try to be concise. I mean, I think being economical with language is one of the really interesting parts of Twitter, and that's what attracts me to it. But you don't have to have, like, you can't break down it, you know, someone's dissertation in 140 characters or even a blog post. Like, the constructive criticism, yeah, it should probably be more than one tweet. There's no one saying it has to be.
But you could do a video or a blog post and tweet about it that, hey, I didn't agree with you because of these reasons, and then post if you have something longer to say. I want to go back to the matter of introducing people to each other.
No, wait, because we're not done with the third tactic.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. What's the third tactic?
Were you leaving? Were you leaving the Twitter conversation, Esther? Or
no.
Oh, okay, good. Sorry, I thought you were going way back. Sorry,
well,
carry on.
I wanted to know about the introducing people to each other, because that's something that I do actually all the time, just because I want to help. But I usually do it through email, because I want to say a little bit more than what I could fit in a tweet. And I wanted to know, what is the advantage of introducing people that do not know each other, like in this case where those people were meeting in London and you connected them based on a mutual interest. Why would you do it on Twitter versus via email or a phone call?
Two reasons. I think Twitter is just easier for someone that uses a lot, like me. Like, I don't have to dig up this person's email address. It'll kind of like autofill their handle or whatever. The other thing is, I think there are kind of, we have associations with email that we don't have with Twitter sometimes. It's more of a private medium. It's to have like someone that's relatively influential, to have their email address is a semi-private thing, I guess, like if they don't publish it. So to expose that email by connecting people, like, it's a judgment call. It just depends on who you're talking about. But in general, it feels more intimate and more serious. And I think that in some context, that makes sense. In this particular context, and with introducing people in general, if there's a way to do it publicly without divulging any information that they don't want to share, then I would do it on Twitter. I don't know. I can't really explain why. It just felt right, because these two people were very active in Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I wanted them to kind of, I think the more ways that you connect with people, the better, because I call this being three-dimensional. When you are in sales, for instance, and you're trying to sell something to someone, and you call them up, and you've never interacted with them in any other way, you may get them to listen to what you have to say, but if you're cold calling them, you're probably going to get hung up on, or they're probably not going to be interested, right? Mm-hmm. That's just numbers, the numbers game. But say that you have tweeted with them before about something you know they're interested in, or you've left a comment on their blog. Well, now you're not the person that's calling me out of the blue. You're the person that I've tweeted with and that took the time to read my blog post and comment. And you start out as like this sketch, and you become something more three-dimensional. The more dimensions that you are interacting with someone with, mm-hmm. the more three-dimensional you become. And the warmer that approach, when eventually you do approach someone to tell them what you want from them or to try to influence them, it's just way warmer and it's likelier. Before this job, before Bizarre Voice, I was in sales. And I was doing a little bit of marketing informally. I didn't know that it was even called marketing, really. But I was blogging, and the people that I was trying to sell things to were all realtors, real estate agents. When I was blogging in a way that was kind of like social media 101 for realtors. And a lot of people would comment on that stuff. And I would call every single one of those people, because I knew, they knew who I was, and we had instantly something to talk about. If they found my post helpful, let me call them and see if I can explain the concepts in that post further, or answer any questions they would have. So I was being more useful, and I never got hung up on if that was the case. If they had blogged, had commented on my blog, I would never get hung up on, because they knew who I was, and I'd already provided them value just with that blog post about mm-hmm. how to use this tool or another tool. Mm-hmm. And then when I'd follow up to offer them more value, they were happy about that. And then I would say, you know, this is the kind of stuff we do at XYZ Company, and I'd love for you to attend this webinar I'm coming up. So then they become kind of part of my pipeline at that point. But it never felt like I was, you know, I'm not tricking them. It never felt like I was adding them to my pipeline. All it was me becoming more familiar to them. And me getting to a point where once we do start talking about, like, this is what I want to sell you, I've established this legacy of adding value already. Social media makes it so much easier to do that because there's this record of the value they've provided you. I can look at my Twitter history with someone, or I can look at my inbox, or I can look at this Facebook thread and see, like, hey, I've talked to this person before, or I've subscribed to their blog, or for some reason I should, you know, pay attention to what they have to say. So when I was in sales, social media helped me immensely. I was terrible at cold calling. Some people are great. I'm not. But it helped me establish a meaningful relationship before the pitch.
Mm-hmm. So it really warms up that relationship. And how do you find, you mentioned earlier that you would not only rely on those ad campaigns that you used to do to get this job at Bizarre Voice and any of the other campaigns that you did, but you also went out a lot to networking events locally. So where is that? Is there an indication that, okay, this is how long I need to interact with someone before I try to meet them in person, or is it formulaic at all, or do you just go to whatever is available to you, particularly when you're an introvert and maybe it's not the easiest thing to go to parties? It's certainly the case for me.
Well, yeah. Some of it's going to just have to involve stepping out of your comfort zone. I think if you're not doing that constantly, you're probably not, like, improving yourself, and you're probably not getting to where you want to be, whatever your comfort zone is. If you're an extrovert, then your comfort zone is different, maybe. But, so you got to step out and do things that make you a little uncomfortable no matter what, even if you're using social media. But, yeah, face-to-face, I think, is still the ultimate way to get to know people. And if you are too systematic and you're too calculating, I don't think, you know, there's going to be important people at this party, so I'm not going to go. If you're thinking like that, you're going to be missing out on opportunities that you did not anticipate, serendipitous opportunities. So I went to a party last week, and I just went because a friend invited me, and I didn't have any agenda. I wasn't going to that party to do any kind of business or networking. But it turned into a conversation about me consulting for someone that I found really interesting. And I didn't anticipate that. And if I had judged that party by, am I going to get business leads out of this, or no, I wouldn't have gone, and I wouldn't have had that opportunity. So I think just being open to it, and you're only really going to be able to do that if you learn to enjoy it and to enjoy meeting people. And you never know when that contact that you acquire and that relationship you start is going to pay off. And if it doesn't, that's fine. Most of them won't, but you'll have someone interesting to talk to. What I find when people that are from the traditional business world join social media, one of the things they do that is, in my opinion, wrong is have a very shrewd business mind and approach to every single thing they do in social media. So that if it's not immediately paying off, or if they can't measure the value in terms of revenue, they don't value it, and they give up too soon. And if that's the only way you're measuring the value you're getting out of social media, which is revenue or leads generated or whatever, you're missing a lot of the value that is a little more intangible and probably pays off in the longer term, but is ultimately way better. And that's all relationship based.
Okay. So coming back to our, we are a little short on time here, but just quickly coming back to our tactics here. The first one was curating content. So getting sharing other people's content, getting new content out there, refreshing content, so forth. The second one was helping and introducing people through their Twitter handles and so forth. And the third tactic.
This one's probably the most tactical tactic because it's like very specific. But when I was starting out in Twitter, again, I had a very thin resume. I had very little experience in the things I was selling. I had never been a real estate agent, but I was talking to them constantly. I joined real estate chats on Twitter, and I would just kind of fit in where I fit in and try to add value whenever I could. I wouldn't just speak for the sake of you know, people paying attention to me, because if you speak out of turn and you don't know what you're talking about, you can get called out. But I felt like I could help, and I felt like I could talk about some of the things that I saw in those chats, and then I would. And people started to follow me, to tweet at me for advice, and I don't care who you are, how influential you are, there's a Twitter chat out there that is like that was for me. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's like you just graduated college and you know a little bit that someone that is about to graduate doesn't know yet, and they could use your advice. Like, find Twitter chats for people that are, you know, that are for students, or there's some place that you can fit in. There's a Twitter chat for you where you can be kind of the elder, the wise person. And or at the very least, there's a Twitter chat for you where you can meet the kind of people you want to meet and get them to pay attention to you because you're contributing interesting things and helping them with people or helping them with ideas or introducing them to people. All adding values in all the ways we've talked about, you can do that in Twitter chats. And at the very least, you might learn something. Even if you don't do anything else and you establish absolutely no more influence than you had before, you're going to still learn a lot. Because most Twitter chats are, at their core, educational. So whatever you do in social, Twitter chats, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, try to learn the whole time. And if that's all you get out of it, that's still probably worth it.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much, Ian, really, for your time and for all this generous insight and everything that you shared here today. And before we go, I have one more question, and that is, sure, how can we become more influential through our marketing?
People think that marketing is all about telling the world why you're great. And the trick is actually to get people to tell that story for you. And so when it comes to blogging, for instance, don't blog about why you're great. Blog about ideas that you can shed light on. And if you're trying to promote something and promote yourself, work that promotion into your social media approach, into the content itself. For instance, when I talk to companies all the time about how to run their content strategy, what do companies do right off the bat? They'll start blogging about their new products and how great they are. Or, hey, our CEO is going to be speaking at this event. Well, no one cares.
Yeah.
Unless you're Google or Facebook or Apple, no one cares. But what if you could blog about the ideas? If you could blog about the ideas behind that talk you're giving, or the ideas that led you to create that product in the first place, the needs that you're meeting, then people start to pay attention. If you're solving a problem through the content itself, if the content itself is valuable, not what you're referring to in the content, people will start to pay attention. And you can promote yourself at the end of that post, for instance, in a little banner ad or something like, if you liked this post, I'm speaking about this at this event. Or we just introduced this new product that meets this need. Mm-hmm. The marketing itself needs to be valuable. If the marketing itself is just referencing value you can provide down the line, people lose interest before they get to that part. And that's the ultimate goal of any marketer, whether you're doing social media, direct mail, anything. Whatever you're putting out there should be in itself valuable. Your Twitter presence, your tweets should be in itself valuable, not just promoting things.
And once
you do that, people will start to pay attention, and then you can ask favors of people. Once you've earned that trust, you can ask them to buy your product. You've got their permission, in a sense. Once they sign up to your list or whatever it is, these indicators, you'll know when the time is right. And they'll want to know what you're doing. When I was in real estate marketing, people would always ask me, after I'd talked to them about what they're doing and how they should approach social media, people would always ask, well, what actually do you sell? They would be interested at that point, but not before that point.
Yeah.
Then, perfect transition. Well, actually, I sell these things, and then I'd get the sale.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Ian. And for people who want to connect with you more and want to work with you or find out more about what you do, where do they go?
Sure. On Twitter, I love to connect with people there. I'm BE3D, B as in boy, E as in earn it, 3, the number 3, D as in David, stands for Be Three Dimensional, the concept I talked about. My blog is daretocomment.com, daretocomment.com. They can find my book on Amazon. I love to connect with readers about that book, so the hashtag is TSMSD, which stands for the Social Media Side Door. If you're reading the book, I want to hear about the ideas in it, what you think of them. Tweet me and use that hashtag, and then you can connect to other readers too. It's a lot of fun.
Fantastic. And we'll put that all that in the show notes as well at borntoinfluence.com/Ian Greenlee so you can find all the good information out there. Thank you so much, Ian. We really, really appreciate you coming here.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And that concludes this interview with Ian Greenlee. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And I really want to thank you because you have been listening to Born to Influence and being super supportive for, guess what? For 99 episodes at this point. And so tomorrow we have a huge milestone that we'll be hitting, which is the release of episode number 100. And in celebration, I'll be also giving you something special in the download section. And in the meantime, I want to invite you to come on over and join the discussion in our brand new Facebook group, which is our community for you influencer. And you can get there in one of two ways. Either type in your browser borntoinfluencecommunity.com, or if you happen to be on Facebook right now, just type in the search bar there, Born to Influence Community, and you'll see the group, and you can just request access. I'll approve you right away, and so we can get to hang out there, all right? And otherwise, I'll see you with a brand new interview tomorrow, same time, same place.